This is Valley Public Radio. I'm David Alves. Good evening. Welcome to Storytellers Showcase. For as long as we've had the ability to speak, humans have been telling stories. Today, storytelling pervades all forms of media: books, music, film, advertising, video games, and more. And yet, nothing is quite as engaging as a live human sharing their story. In December 2019, the Beale Memorial Library in Bakersfield, in association with Bakersfield Toastmaster Clubs and Valley Public Radio, presented an evening of true stories told before a live audience. The stories that evening were recorded, and we're pleased to be able to share them with you tonight.
All right. Are you ready for your first speaker?
Yes.
Okay. When I asked the question, what is something that you tried that you will never ever try again? She said, I accidentally started a bar fight while singing Hit Me With Your Best Shot at karaoke. Telling stories are medicine, Julie Jordan Scott.
I went back and forth and back and forth with this. I want to tell the story. I don't want to tell the story. I want to tell the story. I don't want to tell the story. I want to tell the story. I don't want to tell the story. And then I remembered what happened before. Actually, what happened after. And what happened after was I was looking across my feet as I laid in the bed in the intensive care unit. And I saw the nurse who had been taking care of me standing there. And I looked at her and I said, Lise, I believe stories are medicine, and I would love to hear your story. So may I ask you a question, and then you can answer it and tell me a bit of your story? And I watched what happened with Lise. She stood up a little bit straighter, and a smile went across her face. She said, yes, you may ask me a question. So I took a deep, courageous breath. And now I'll tell you what happened before that moment. So I found myself in the intensive care unit of Adventist Health Hospital in October. I went in for pneumonia, which seemed like a pretty ordinary ailment to go into the hospital for. And after 2.5 days, they were getting ready to release me, when all of a sudden I felt really, really cold, really extremely, extremely cold. And I asked one of the nurses for a blanket. So I was shivering so much that she went and got me a heated blanket. And when she tried to take my temperature or tried to check my oxygen level using those little things they put on your finger when they take your vital signs, it wouldn't compute. That's how cold I had gotten. I was so cold that they couldn't see my oxygen levels. They weren't showing up. And it felt as if, when she put the blankets on me, it felt like this big waterfall was coming over me, and I was getting pushed under water. And I just remembered this whiteness coming over me. And it was a day and a half later that I met Lise. And I was lying in my bed in the intensive care unit, and I was totally attached to my bed. I mean, there was no way that I could move. I had an IV. I had an oxygen mask on. I had a catheter. I had all kinds of stuff constantly monitoring my body. And I looked up at the ceiling, and I thought, wow, I really want to check out that round pipe or whatever that thing is up there in the ceiling. I really want to see what that's like up there. And I felt myself go up toward that pipe, again, like I was swimming. And I swam, flew, I'm not sure what, into the pipe. And I could feel the pipe with my hands and my feet, which was strange because I was tied into this bed. There was no way I could get out of this bed. But yet there I went, towards this light, just like that light up there. It was just like that. And I was going toward the light, investigating the tunnel, and very conscious of how it felt. It felt like kind of like a slick, soft kind of concrete. And I could feel it with my hands and my feet, and I was much more limber than I am in that bed. And I said to myself, wow, if I go any further, I might not be able to find my way back. if I go to that light where I can see things clearly, and it looks so compelling, I might not be able to go back down there. And I look towards my feet, darkness, no clarity, paradox. That's where I was stuck in that moment. And yet I knew that down there, back in the intensive care unit, back in that fight that my body was in the middle of, were my children and my friends, and most importantly, the work that I was meant to do in this world. So the next thing I knew, I was back in the bed, and Lisa's voice, melodic, Jamaican, said, "Julie, I need you to wake up. Your heart rate is very low." So I opened my eyes and I thought, how am I going to make my heart rate go up? I can't do any kind of great exercises while I'm tied into the bed. And I started to do an exercise where, like in theater, where we do crazy eights, and sure enough, I caught my heart pumping again. And I chose, in that moment that I stepped back in the darkness, I chose life over choosing going to the light. And Lise, whose stories are medicine, I said to her, "So, Lise," borrowing a quote from Anne Lamott, "what did you eat for lunch when you were in the second grade?" And through that simple question, she gave me a concrete answer, not only to what she had for lunch as a second grader, turns out she didn't have lunch, and how she went from being a hungry 8-year-old little girl in Jamaica to a successful nurse at Adventist Health Hospital, who literally brought me back to life.
Keep it going for Julie Jordan Scott, everyone. Fantastic. Up next, I asked our next speaker, what's something that you tried that you will never, ever try again? And she said, going up to the top of the Stratosphere in Las Vegas because she's terrified of heights. I wouldn't do that again if I was terrified of heights either. Please give it up. My Uncle Tom by Verda Varner.
Good evening, my friends. I would like to tell you about my Uncle Tom. Now, he was one of my mother's older brothers. And that side of the family would be best described as zany. They were attractive. There were six of the kids. They were attractive, but they were all gifted in their own way. Musicians, dancers, singers. And Uncle Tom was an artist. He could draw anything. Worked for Disney in the early days. Got fired from Disney in the early days because one thing that ran through that side of my mom's family, they loved to drink. So he lost the job at Disney, and everyone was happy when he got a job working for the Navy, not in the Navy, but for the Navy. And they were even happier when he was sent to Pearl Harbor, Hawaii. It was like being in San Diego. He was working and having a good salary and doing well, except there were Saturday nights. Well, Saturday night, December 6th, he went out and got, as he described it, knee-walking, gutter-falling down, drunk, picked up by the shore patrol, and taken to the brig. The next morning, they came in early and offered the guys in the brig a choice. You can stay here in the brig where it's hot and stuffy and smelly because all of you guys had been drunk, or you can go to the galley, to the kitchen, and be kitchen help. Well, Uncle Tom reluctantly raised his hand, figuring anything's better than staying in that brig. And he went in, and they said, "Well, Tom, we want you to peel potatoes." He got the bag of potatoes, got the big bin that he was going to peel him in, got the knife, and thought, I don't think I have to stay in the galley to do this. I can pull it outside and sit in the warm tropical breeze, because, as he explained, he had the mother of all hangovers. So he was sitting out there peeling potatoes, enjoying himself, thinking, I feel bad for those sorry suckers that are back in the brig. I'm out here enjoying myself. And then all of a sudden, the noise started. He wasn't altogether sure what it was. It sounded like gunfire and explosions and planes. And, you know, what were they doing messing up his headache like that? And he looked up, and sure enough, it was Japanese Zeros flying in. And he got angry. What are they doing? It's Sunday morning. We're all hungover. Let us alone. Then he realized, hey, they're not joking. They're attacking. And he had nothing to fight back with except the potatoes. He swears this is a true story, too. He picked up the potatoes and started chucking them at the Zeros as they came over. Now, I hope to goodness I live long enough to see a documentary about Pearl Harbor, a Zero that they have uncovered that is covered in some sort of weird vegetative material, perhaps potato. Thank you.
That was Verda Varner telling a story about her Uncle Tom, recorded December 7, 2019 at the Beale Memorial Library in Bakersfield. Next, Cheryl Ann Farley tells a story about the high cost of wealth.
Good evening. One of the aspects of being a traveling private chef is you're exposed to many homes that have a phenomenal level of not just exposed wealth, but also exposed rooms and exposed families. I'm always reminded by the original French chef, the first TV chef, Julia Child, who said, anytime you're preparing a dish, always start off with a larger pot than you think you're going to need. So on this particular assignment, I drove up to the gate. I talked to the security guard. He reminded me I needed to park in staff parking and to not go into the front door. I drove and parked. I walked to my assignment, and I went to the back door where there was a security pad and I needed a password. I had neither of those things. So I walked all the way around to the front door, which was standing open. I pushed it open a little bit more and I started shouting. And instead, what hit me was this pungent wave of alcohol and pizza boxes, and obviously they had been using this area of the house as a party room. So I pushed the door open a little bit more. I started walking to the back of the house where I knew the kitchen would be, and I was so thrilled I didn't trip over any dead bodies. I got to the kitchen, and of course it was very tidy. So I started finding the coffee maker, the coffee, the toaster, bread, butter, and jam. And I waited. And I waited some more. So in a few minutes, I decided, well, all right, let me make myself useful. So these large properties typically have some kind of a kitchen garden or an herb garden. So I walked out, and I gathered some herbs I would use in the cooking later. I came into the house, and then I looked across the bar. And there was a person standing there, stock still, like a statue, in these dirty, grimy pajamas, sweats, all bones and elbows and knobs, stock still and not speaking. So I started the toast and the coffee, and I waited. I noticed, as I stuck my head around the corner, that this individual, I had no idea if they were male or female, had this terrific haircut. It was all down in their face and wonderful colors, and I was just so impressed with that. And I took the coffee, and I took the toast and the butter and jam, and I knew from looking at this person that they had all the outward evidence of having an eating disorder. And this was not at all unusual in these very wealthy families. So I took the toast, and I cut it into columns. Then I took a column, and I cut it into three sections, about the size of a postage stamp. One section, I left the toast on the outside. The other section was crustless. I put that butter and jam on a little plate. Then I took a cup, and I poured a tiny amount of coffee in it. And I set it on the counter, and I went back to my spot on the wall. In a few minutes, I heard a sneeze. And then this individual walked up to the bar, and I could see it was a young girl, or a girl somewhere between maybe 11 and 20. She walked over to the cupboard, and she got out a bowl and a box of cereal, set it on the bar. Then she walked into the, opened the refrigerator, and took out a little bowl of coffee creamers, those little individual coffee creamers. She set that on the bar. She pulled a chair over, and then she proceeded to curl up in the chair, tucking her legs and her arms in, until she reminded me of a dying spider. And she sat in that chair, not a word, and she started opening up the coffee creamers and drinking them. She had a pile of maybe five or six, and then she picked up a little square of toast, the one that had the crust on the edge, and wandered away into this icy, cold, enormous house in what I could only assume was all by herself. So I waited a few minutes. Nothing else happened. I made a fresh pesto, vegetable soup, some pasta. I wrapped everything up and I put it in the refrigerator. And as I headed home, because I had miles to go before I was going to sleep, I thought of this poor little rich girl. Now her pot was maybe a little bit bigger than what she needed. Thank you.
That was The High Cost of Wealth, a true story told by Cheryl Ann Farley. This is Storyteller's Showcase on Valley Public Radio, and we're sharing stories that were recorded December 7th, 2019 from Miles to Go Before I Sleep, a program of true stories told to a live audience put on by the Beale Memorial Library in Bakersfield together with Bakersfield Toastmasters Clubs. Next, Marilyn Stewart tells the saga of Tina and Meow.
This happened, maybe 20 years or so ago at a no-kill rescue for homeless dogs that my former husband and I created, Alpha Saint Canine Sanctuary. He came in out of the darkness, and he stood in the middle of the kitchen, and he had this kind of round-eyed look. He didn't say a word, but he had this look people get sometimes when they see something, but they just can't believe what they've seen. And finally he spoke, and he said, "Tina has a cat in her house, and she's sleeping with it." Well, Tina, 90-pound Doberman mix, whose roommate was Zippy, another dog, equally large, it was quite unlikely that the cat would be in one piece. And I asked nervously, "Is the cat okay?" He said, "Yep." First thing in the morning, he was down the hill again, and a little gray Maltese cat was cuddled up to Tina. She left a little later, went out hunting, I assume, around the sanctuary in the country. And that night she came back, and she joined Tina again. And in about 2 weeks, my former husband came up the hill again with a round-eyed look and said, "That cat is having kittens in Tina's house." We had named the cat Meow, by the way. And it was not going well. Tina was very happy with the kitten. She was very nurturing. Meow had moved over, displaced Zippy out of his doghouse, was sitting there in the door, glaring at the kittens with pure hatred. One of the kittens rolled out of the door onto the ground. Tina leaped up, jumped out, picked up the kitten in her mouth, brought it back to the house. Well, the birth was premature, and none of the kittens survived, probably to Meow's great relief. She continued to live with Tina, and in a couple of weeks, she was feral. We couldn't catch her, so we could get her in a dog trap. We caught her, hauled her off to the veterinarian, got her spayed again, since motherhood was definitely not for her. And she continued living with Tina for probably another 3 years. Alpha Canine Sanctuary is in the foothills. People dump animals out there all the time. And it does not go well for them. Most of them do not survive. But Meow, she was smart, and she was a survivor. We don't know where she went. We do know that she left with us a memory we will never forget. Thank you.
This next person I asked, what is something that you've tried that you will never try again? And she said, angel dust. Please, everyone, give it up for Norma Jane.
I am Norma Jane, and I have lots of stories, and I had intended on telling 10 different other stories. But when she said, what is something you will never try again? Angel dust. It's been many, many years as opposed to last week. And what had happened was, went to a party, peer pressure, didn't want to admit. Hey, you want to try this? You know, it's got a little dust on it, and you know what that is? Of course I know. Come on now. And they rolled up, what do you call it, in a doobie, and they spring up. We're going to put a little dust on it. I'm like, cool, no problem. They said, now don't smoke at all. I'm like, it's a joint. And I'm rolling along. I got it. And I was like, I smoke it on the way home. So halfway home, I decided to take a shortcut. I saw this really dark alley. Seemed like a good idea at the time. And I cut through the alley, and I'm like, man, this sure is a bumpy alley. And when I get back and I look and it's lit up, I realize I had just driven my new car through a glass-filled alley. But I'm like, wow, the alley's shiny. I mean, and I said, you know what? No more alleys. I'm going to get on the freeway. I get on the freeway. I got a new car. I'm speeding, and the car is going kaboom, 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 kaboom. What is wrong with my people are pulling up? Hey! I'm like, what's wrong with those people? And I'm kaboom, 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 kaboom. I'm in the fast lane doing 65. And after the third person said, you need to pull over. I'm like, okay. Got off the freeway, went to the gas station, and I said, maybe I have a flat. And got out the car, driver's side. I looked at the rear tire. It was fine. Walked around to the passenger side. It was fine. And looked at the front. Like, 3 out of 4. I'm good. 3 out of 4. And that's good enough for me. And no time did it occur to me to check the fourth tire. The front one. Remember, I got out of the car and came around. So I got back on the freeway. I got 3 good tires. What could go wrong? I'm on the freeway. Speed, I saw sparks. And I said, you know what? Maybe the weirdest thing for me about that angel dust night is that I didn't realize I was doing 70 on a rim. Exactly. So obviously, if I was in my right mind, I probably would have noticed. And police officer pulled up. He says, pull over now. And I pulled over, and he said, ma'am, did you see the spark? I said, I felt something was wrong. I just couldn't put my finger on it. And he was very kind. Like I said, this was over 20 years ago. And he said, you're a young lady. You're out here by yourself. He's like, I don't know what you're on, but you probably need to go home. But I sat there, got the tire fixed, went home, and knowing that I was that totally unaware because of something I smoked, that's where it comes from. I will never do angel dust again. Just saying.
This next speaker told me there's absolutely nothing that he would try again. Wouldn't try again. The man that needs no introduction, Red.
I'm Red. Normally I go to work, I drive between 12 to 14 hours and work another 12 to 14 hours. This particular day I was given a job briefing to the guys that I work with, and right in the middle of the job briefing, I fell out. Mighty surprised, when I finally wake up, I find a good friend of mine. He's over me, slapped me in the face. I'm like, hey, what's going on? You all right? You all right? We're getting ready to take you to the doctor. And me being who I am, I'm kind of bullheaded. If people who knew me, they'll tell you otherwise. Some things I don't want to say in front of everybody. So the next day, I drove home, went to the doctor that morning. Later on, I picked up my daughter and went to my brother's bike shop show. You know, we're out there having fun, doing everything that we normally want to do, clowning, racing bikes, doing slow drags, and whatever, you know, bikers do. Well, I get this phone call. Phone call from my doctor. She says, where are you at? And I said, you know, being a smart mutt, who I am, I tell them, doing what I want to do. And she says, no, seriously, where are you? I said, at my brother's bike shop show. We need to know this because we're going to be sending an ambulance to your location. Well, the heat that I received from that phone call was burning my ear. And you ever heard of, pretty sure you guys are old enough to know who Charlie Brown is? The voice, that you hear that wah, 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 that was going through my head at the time. And at that moment, I just snapped and I said, well, got to go. Grabbed my daughter and shot home. When I got home, I told my wife, we got to go to the hospital. She kind of looked at me like crazy, like, what? You? What? And I said, if you're not in the car by the time I get there, I guess I'm leaving you. So she jumped in the car, and we went to Memorial. And next thing you know, I get checked in, go outside, sit around, and we're talking. You know, I'm feeling okay. I look around, look over there. There's people over in the emergency ward. Cars are all over there, and I make a joke, and I look at the nurse that come out the door, and she's looking around, and I tell my wife, I must be a 5150, because she looked up in the air. Next thing you know, I get grabbed, and I said, we're taking you to emergency room right now. When I get there, I go in through the surgery, and next thing you know, when I wake up, I got tubes all over my body, chest, places I don't even want to describe. The doctor says, you're lucky to be alive. And I look at him, I says, what's going on? He says, your blood count was a level 2. It was a corpse. Next thing you know, I look at him and I said, well, I could be on The Walking Dead, huh? With no problem. The doctor kind of looks at me, smirks, and kind of chuckles, and that's just me. Well, that was the beginning of my whole trilogy. I started on dialysis, and what I found out was I had lost both kidneys, liver, and pancreas were failing me. As I began to do dialysis, I went to this facility to learn how to do it. I walk in, I'm the type of person, I say, hey, how you doing? Hello, how you going? I walked in and I seen this empty seat, and that's where I was going to possibly be sitting. There's a gentleman on the right and a gentleman on the left. Guy on the right, I said, hey, how you doing? He just kind of smiled, waved his hand at me. The guy on the left looked at me and says, I don't even want to know your name. I don't care who you are. Don't even sit by me. I don't want to know nothing, blah, 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 blah. I looked at him and I said, hey, what's the matter with this guy? Who pissed in his cornflakes? And he says, no, when he meets someone, every person he meets dies. So immediately I looked down and said, hey, nice knowing you, nice meeting you. I'm out the door. I'm walking away. And that was the time I started learning how to do dialysis at home. I went home. I would do 10 hours of dialysis every night. The pain that's in there is excruciating. I mean, you can smell the blood leaving from your body. I've been doing this for about a year and a half. I get a phone call one night. There was a little girl who had passed away from her teacher had hit her while she was texting and driving. At that moment, I'm thinking, why are you calling me when you have your daughter dying? But that was my guardian angel. Her parents thought more of me to allow me to receive that little girl's kidney. And I was blessed the day before Valentine's Day. So every time I think of Valentine's Day, my guardian angel, Ashley, she'll always be with me, just like I let her parents know. If you see me, you see your daughter, and I'll take care of her because she took care of me. There's many blessings in this. Never forget you have a guardian angel. Never forget there's a man up above who will take care of you. And that's my story. Thank you for listening.
Next is Miss P. She's going to tell us a story about Round.
All my life, I've been round. At birth, I weighed a whopping 8 pounds, 12 ounces, and I was 2 months premature. Can you imagine if I had been carried full term? My Auntie Sally, she was 5 feet tall and all of 110 pounds. And she tell my mama, oh, my Nance is just baby fat. It'll fall off once she starts school. My Uncle Joe, he was a giant at 6'5 and about 300 pounds. He pinched my little fat cheeks and he say, hey, Missy Prissy. How are you today? So you see, I didn't know that there was anything wrong with being round. I thought I was just like everybody else. Well, honey, I had a rude awakening. My first day at kindergarten, them kids, they stood all around me. They was teasing me, kicking me and hitting me and calling me fatty. Till Ernest told them to leave me alone, because see, I wasn't messing with them. If you call her fat just one more time, I'm gonna knock you upside the head. Ernest was that little fair-skinned boy smiling at me in a red plaid button-down shirt, Big Ben jeans, bro gangs, and a car coat. He didn't live in the projects like I did, and his mama came to pick him up after school. He was my knight in shining armor. Nobody said another word. I knew we would be friends forever until I came back to school after Christmas break and he was gone. Yes, being round has some drawbacks. Like nobody wants you on their team in a relay race no matter how fast you run. Somebody want to be your friend, but they don't want to get teased. And you know they watch me every minute when I was walking or talking or even sitting about. And honey, please don't think they'd let me eat my lunch in the cafeteria. Even though we were all served the same thing, they would stop eating their lunch to watch me eat mine. But I never knew what they were thinking, that I was going to swallow my lunch whole, the plate, the tray, and all. My teacher would say, Missy, you're such a smart girl. Why don't you ever raise your hand or come and write the answer on the blackboard? But see, she couldn't hear them kids in the back of the room whispering.
Of course she knows the answer. Elephants never forget.
Honey, living in the projects is hard enough. But many of my classmates were hungry and dirty, and their parents didn't care if they lived or died. I was loved by my mama and my sisters, and they helped me with my homework. Them kids were mad because I was smart. You know, after school, after I finished my chores and my homework, if I didn't have a book to read, I'd watch TV. I love television, and I watched it all the time. After church on Sunday, we'd go to the matinee. It only cost 25 cents. I loved it, too. You know, there weren't as many color people movies, but I liked them all. You know, I even daydreamed of being a movie star. I was in every movie and on every show. I was really quite round, and I didn't realize that it was actually an advantage. The advantage being, everybody could see me no matter where I was, so all I had to do is get them to like me for who I really was, you know, inside. But before I could expect anybody else to like me, I had to like myself. So I remember something my daddy used to say when I was just a little bitty girl. He said, "Baby, you got a special sparkle. You've been kissed by an angel. That's why you're so sweet. You could charm the devil himself with that smile." So I start charming myself. I start finding all the things that I liked about me. Funny thing was, the more I looked, the more I liked what I saw. And when people would say, "Fat girls don't wear shorts or go swimming at the beach. You can't be no contestant in no beauty pageant." I said, "That's too bad. I love to go swimming at the beach on a hot day. And everybody wears shorts in the summertime. And I am a contestant in a beauty pageant. So there." In time, I realized that people see you as you see yourself. This world has all kind of shapes, sizes, and colors. It would be quite boring if everything and everybody were the same. Beauty is what I now see in the mirror. After all, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, but sometimes you have to adjust the viewer's vision. Thank you.
When I asked our next and last speaker of the night what she tried that she will never try again, she said karaoke. Here to tell us too much of a good thing is Sarah Rodriguez.
Tis the season, right? Tis the season of stress and more stress. The other day I was trying to think of pleasant holiday memories from my childhood, and I was talking to my parents at Thanksgiving, and I said, "Do you remember the time that we got all those boxes from Harry and David?" And at first, they didn't remember. They're like, "What?" And then my dad's like, oh my gosh, yeah, I remember. I said, "Don't you remember me and my older brother and sister? We walked home from school one day, and I remember walking down our long driveway, because we lived in Colorado at the time, and getting to the front of our house, and at the front door were just piles and piles of cardboard boxes." And we were like, what the heck is going on? And I'm the youngest of three, so I was kind of like the bratty little sister, and I was like, "It's Santa!" And they're like, "No, Sarah, like, it's from the post office." I'm like, okay. We go in, and my mom, she's like, I don't know. Let's see who it's from. They were from Harry and David. Is anybody familiar with Harry and David, the catalog? All of the fruit baskets and chocolates and just expensive yumminess that everybody else can afford, but we had never really seen before in that quantity. So every year, every Christmas, we got one thing from our well-to-do relatives in upstate New York. The dad was a physician, and I think he was like my mom's second cousin. So we would get maybe a tin of cookies, perhaps a fruitcake, and we were like, yay, we're loved. Well, apparently, that Christmas, Harry and David as a company made a mistake. And all of the orders that Phil and his wife and their very lovely, well-to-do family sent out to their many, many relatives all over the United States, we got. Heck yes. And after my mom called the company, she's like, what do you want me to do with all this stuff? Do we need to send it back? They said, oh, no, ma'am. It's our oversight. So because of that, you know, we're going to remedy it. We're going to make sure the orders are sent out correctly. And you get to keep everything. And I was maybe 6 or 7 at the time. And I was like, oh, my God, like freaking out. What can we open first? You know, and I remember, like, there was just piles of things. Like, we ran out of room. You know, there was like the Tower of Treats with the truffles and the, then there was like an entire tray of just smoked meat, you know, salami and whatever other smoked meat they had. There was cheese, there was fruit baskets, there was truffles. I mean, it was insane. It was overwhelming. So when my dad got home, we decided as a family that we would each get to pick out something. And we all very early on developed our favorites. I remember my brother, it was all about the smoked meat to the point where I think he was going to make himself sick. And my sister was very into the trays of cheese and the cute little crackers. And, you know, she's the oldest. And so everything would be very like cutely arranged and she'd make little sandwiches. And then me, I just wanted all the candy, all the chocolate, all the cookies. I could not get enough of the sugar. So we all had our favorites. And I'd say that first night, everybody was in heaven, right? It was beautiful. Day two, it was starting to get like where we're passing around the Pepto-Bismol, you know, maybe too much of a good thing, right? Day three, we were like, yay, what do we open next? It's funny how so much excess kind of quickly loses its appeal. But, so day three, my mom says, we're going to have a family meeting. She was very big on family meetings. Everyone gather around, children. Your father and my dad was like, what? Yes, your father and I have decided that we're going to start donating some of these things to other people. We're going to donate one to church, one of the big baskets. We're going to take something to a 4-H meeting because we were in 4-H at the time. And I remember we freaked out. Like, as kids, we were like, no, we want to keep it all. Like our feeling, it was fate. Like, you know, in each of the children, we really showed our, like, birth order and our age and stage at the time because my sister was, you know, mother, I've really thought seriously about this. And I think if we, you know, if we catalog the food that will last the longest, then, you know, it could, like, see us through the winter. And my brother was like, I just want smoked meat, you know. And I was like, can we just kind of keep some of the candy? And then I'm like sneaking it away, you know, hiding it in my bedroom. So we wound up giving away quite a bit of it. And I would say in the end that the thing that I remember the most about that entire experience is just like how fun it was as a family to experience having so much of what we thought we had been missing out on. And then, you know, to realize in the end that at the end of the day, it's just a bunch of smoked meat, right? Cheese or whatever. Anyway, I got a Harry and David catalog the other day and I was like looking through it like, oh, the Riviera pears, the smoked meat. And it's like I had no desire to order any of it, but it was such a good memory. So thank you.
Give it up again for all of our speakers tonight. You guys were fantastic.
This has been Storytellers Showcase, an evening of stories recorded before a live audience in December 2019 at the Beale Memorial Library in Bakersfield. Thanks to the Beale Memorial Library and Bakersfield Toastmaster Clubs who put together that program. Of course, thanks to all the storytellers. Julie Jordan Scott, Verda Varner, Cheryl Ann Farley, Marilyn Stewart, Norma Jane, Red, Miss P, and Sarah Rodriguez. For Valley Public Radio, I'm David Aus. We hope you enjoyed hearing all those great stories in Storytellers Showcase. We've got enough time left in this hour to hear music of Frédéric Chopin. Piano Sonata No. 3 in B minor, Opus 58. It's the last of Chopin's piano sonatas, completed in 1844. It's considered to be one of his most difficult compositions, both technically and musically. Vladimir Ashkenazy performs the first movement, the Allegro Maestoso.
Thank you.
That was pianist Vladimir Ashkenazy performing the music of Frédéric Chopin, Piano Sonata No. 3 in B minor, Opus 58. We heard the first movement,